in Bhaktivinoda's writings, in his books, in his lectures, the magazine that he wrote, and to look at how he answered certain kinds of questions. And so these questions are in all different areas of spiritual life and of philosophy. And it just looks at something he said or wrote, particularly in relationship to that particular topic. So I thought it would be interesting to look at some of the varieties of things that he has given us as part of our legacy, as he is the grandfather spiritual master in some cases. And how much of what Bhaktivinoda did was just so amazing, because how he was such a perfect spiritualist. He was a wonderful father, writer, manager, magistrate judge, managing Jagannath Temple. He did so many things, which brought in something new to the modern day Vaishnavas. That in ancient times, there'd be sort of a guru and a mob of disciples, jealous, teachers, who would then be a part of the Gurukula situation. And some moths would then relate to other moths. But it was much more kind of simplistic. And we see Bhaktivinoda, Bhaktisiddhanta, and Srila Prabhupada, they were maintaining this chastity, but at the same time, they facilitated this knowledge being spread all over the world. They were concerned about such. Of course, we see how Srila Prabhupada really took that to heart and arranged so many different centers and temples and farms and projects and devoting some of this to all different backgrounds. But we have Bhaktivinoda to be very grateful in this way, because this is really very foremost his concern. And at the time that he was very prominent, the people in general had even began to look down, you know, on Vaishnavas, because there was so many Sahadiyas. And these Sahadiyas had caused people to think that the Vaishnava movement was just a movement of people who were devotees, who were engaged in illicit activities, that women would even leave their husbands or minimize the relationship with their bona fide wives and would engage in what we now refer to in modern day time as orgies and all kinds of crazy things. But somehow they were doing this, and with the superficial understanding that it was something spiritual and that it was okay, that it was authorized. And Prabhupada, we look at the things he warned us of, that Sahajism was one of the greatest dangers. He warned us, of course, of the atheists who want to deny that. Once before, it's called one of the devotees, some pillows. Let me get pillows, there's some pillows. Yes, you're going to call for. He warned us of the cheating atheists, or the envious atheists who hated Krishna, hated God. He warned us of the cheating scientists who were eager to explain everything, but somehow not to involve God. Talk about whatever you want, but don't bring in Krishna. We see much of academics is like that, and sometimes people will pursue all kind of ways to analyze things. And then they have a religious studies department, sometimes in a remote area, even of the campus. A few people learn some dogma. And he also warned about the dangers of impersonalists, even voidists, the danger of the smarta brahmanas, who also were close in that they were involved in the Vedic culture. but that they wanted to make similar to a discussion we had last night with leaders of different religious faiths, rabbis and priests and whatnot. And so I gave an address, and then they had to try to kind of not attack, but to present something after I gave the address. And we were emphasizing how one must be sensitive to dogma or to fanaticism. And that fanaticism is dealing with the tradition, but does not go in understanding the heart of the tradition. A fanaticism is even when people take things out of context. This can happen in any, and does happen in all religions and all faiths, where someone can minimize what the heart and essence of that particular theology, and look at some of the externals or take things out of context to justify some kind of concern that they have. And so we see that happen in apartheid. It happens with, you know, with suicide bombers. It happens with fanatic Christians. It happens on all levels. It happens with fanatic Hindus. There are organizations that are fully into nationalism and body, and so they have contaminated the Vedic culture. And it happens, of course, with the smarter Brahmins. And so, in all of these cases, instead of the religion being in harmony, an emphasis on what is proper and the wonderful goals that can be achieved, that it often takes a more position of like politics or business, even for this instance. There are little ways. It's over there somewhere. So Bhaktivinoda was very concerned about people being able to go into the interior to understand what is really the heartbeat of what is Vaishnava Dharma, what is the difference between that and what the Sahajiyas had begun to be involved in. So he didn't do like some of the, I think they called the Bhadralokas at his time, who were intelligent, upper middle class Bengalis who were literally embarrassed with what was happening with the Sahajiya culture and the Smarta Brahmanas. And they overreacted themselves. And their embarrassment, then they started rejecting that which was really really authentic and genuine. So in their embarrassment, they then just started accepting more Shakespeare and T.S. Eliot and Christianity, because they became disturbed not only with what was considered Vaishnavism, it did now become Sahajiyism, but they were then harassed by the British, who would make fun and would call it sacrilegious when they saw Shiva worship and Kali worship and Durga worship and Shakti worship in general. And so, because they couldn't really understand themselves what this really entailed and were embarrassed by the deviance, then they wanted to practically reject their whole involvement in, you know, in Vedic culture. And so they adopted all the ways of the English, etc. So Bhaktivinoda then had both of these kind of camps to have to deal with. Those who were exploiting Vaishnavism, Sahajiyas, and now three camps, the British, who, because many of the British scholars who were studying Indology and things like that, they had ill motive. They were just studying to see how to convert or how to look at what the Indian people were doing that was wrong. And so they wrote their books and their journals. But really, you know, they had ulterior motive. And so a lot of history that people have accepted about, Vedic culture in general was written by Christian scholars who were deep in their Christianity, missionaries, who really were against what they saw was is just sexual expressions. They would go into the temples or see outside the temples, and they would see, you know, pictures of demigods, and they would think, oh, these idols, what would they say, of the Murtis. And they hear about Durga worship and Shiva worship. I mean, because when you think about it, these things are pretty far out. One has to have the adhikara to understand. When you think about Brahma with so many heads, person from a Krishna perspective, look at his dad and say, what is this? What to say if, you know, they give out the stories or see the picture, you know, of the Sringa day, and then they hear about a Ananta sage, snake. What are these people doing? And then they go to the temple and they see, you know, Shiva Linga. They're worshiping a genital. What are these people? Because, you know, it's Sakti worship Shiva. So it was very confusing. And on top of all of that, they see the pictures and the paintings, you know, of Krishna Lila, of Rasa Lila. So it's as if Krishna also created arrangements to keep people out who don't really have the sukriti or jnana sukriti to come that close. It's just like when people go to Vrindavan, some people they go to see the Jamuna, they see it and they just see a dirty place and they can't really enter into the deeper connection. And so that's there. But then one who has the eyes open, open the eyes by the touch of the mercy of Guru and Sadhu, then such persons can have the insight and how to understand such. So why don't you stop hiding behind? So I speak to people's eyes. I don't know if he's sleeping. So if I'm sleeping, then I'll go to sleep also. Wake us all up in 10 minutes. So we'll read some questions that are presented, and Bhaktivinoda gives answer. What is the difference between Samartha Dharma and Sadhana Bhakti? As we said, Prabhupada warned us about Samartha Brahmanas. Those who do not understand the internal or the essential message. Smarta Dharma is another name for worldly morality. The prescribed religious principles designed to bring about spiritual advancement are called sadhana bhakti. Question 5. What is the ultimate benefit for a conditioned soul? Answer. Conditioned souls are prone to material enjoyment, and thus it is inevitable they will suffer in the cycle of birth and death. Serving Krishna by giving up material enjoyment brings about their ultimate benefit. So here he's saying the ultimate benefit comes when one gives up material enjoyment. So people pursue enjoyment, which is natural. That people want ruchi. Everybody wants taste, happiness, pleasure, some stimulation, some excitement, some adventure. Everyone is engaged in some kind of pursuance of some type of relationships. Only a dead person, even a person dead, it's only temporary because then you take birth again. So everyone has some feelings and some activities and expressions. Some dharma. Something that exists, it means it has a dharma. It has something that is essential about. If it doesn't exist, then there's no dharma. So if something's existing, then there's some purpose, some dharma, some relationship to something else. And that's why impersonalism also is a misnomer. Because how can there be something that doesn't have some interaction with something else if it exists? If it exists, it's an evaluated relationship to something else. We say something is cold because it's related to something that's hot, or relationship to some degrees of temperature. Even we take a chair, a table. We understand a chair, a table, because the chair has the dharma of that you use it for sitting or something. So it has some purpose that it is more genuinely to be used for, according to what it is. So for something to be impersonal and not have a purpose, an essence, not have a relationship to something else, it doesn't exist. If it exists, then it has some kind of relationship. It's in connection with something else that exists. What is the duty of an embodied soul? As long as you have this material body, carefully remain fixed in the principles of bhakti. Always serve the devotees. Chant the name of Krishna. Worship Radha and Krishna, and remain indifferent to sense gratification. By the mercy of the devotees, the holy name and the Dham keep undesirable association far away. Soon you will attain residence in the eternal Dham, where pure service to Radha and Krishna will manifest. So here he's saying, as long as one is in material body, that works very hard to remain fixed. Fixed what? In the principles of bhakti. And one way to do that is to always serve the devotees while chanting the Lord's name. Because even if we do work, but if we're not chanting, we're not hearing, we're not engaged in the Sangha, the association, where we have a chance to grow and to experience, get feedback, get help, learn in different situations, then we'll still be in danger. The bhakti creeper will not be, probably protected. And this is one of the beauties that we see in bhakti, the culture of bhakti, that it's not only just philosophy, or it's not just only rituals, or it's not just only a socialization, but it's all of those in connection with the scripture. It's like there are different groups and organizations that have borrowed and stole things from the Gita, from the Purana, from the Ramayana, from Upanishad. They steal some things, and then they create their own kind of system of yoga or some type of mystery school. But there is no culture. They don't honor festivals as we do. They don't understand about these personalities. They don't understand how to work on themselves. And so they're more into this little knowledge about something, some esoteric knowledge. And so we can see they believe in life after death, or reincarnation. They have some understanding that there's higher realms and dimensions. They have some understanding that one should try to learn something from some kind of master. But they don't understand that real learning means you involve all your senses. To involve all your senses, it means eating becomes a way of service to Krishna. Sleeping, mating. It means working for Krishna, as well as thinking of Krishna through Sravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, Andanam, through all of these processes that all together create healthy protection and system of bhakti. So in some cases, people may just be more into the knowledge or to jnana, not understanding or pursuing vijnana, or people may even love the dramas connected with Vedic culture, and learn the songs and the dance, but then not study the philosophy. So you have both sides where people may involve in some cultural expressions, but it becomes more social or entertaining. And the other side is people involved in some intellectual reflections, but then they're not involving themselves. It's kind of similar to someone who comes around the devotees, as much as they get some books and they go home, or get books in the streets, so they can make some advancement. But the real advancement is when they are now reading the book, but then they come and they have darshan with the deities. They come and hear it being discussed. Because just by home, being at home and reading Bhagavad Gita and reading, you know, Bhagavatam, there's only so much they can get from that. Because it's not, there's a verse in Bhagavatam that says like this, that love of God cannot be experienced by jnana, by tapa, by yoga, not fully. Or part of the verse we read yesterday, Bhakyamam Abhijanani, only by devotional service. But Bhagavatam says, it's actually locked up in the heart of the pure, you see, devotee. So Krishna is making himself available so much through quality sadhu, you know, through acharya, acharyavan through shobhaya. We know the acharyas and we know what is what. So if we follow the instructions, then this love of God that they are genuinely connected with, we become candidates for the mercy. We're able to have the love of God within us that's so dormant, once again rekindled. It's like if people are tied down, ropes and things, and someone who's not so tied, or someone who's not tied at all, they can help us. So then they untie part of our rope, it's incarcerating us. And now, after we get somewhat untied, now we have to do our work to finish it, get the rest of the ropes off. So they don't fully take all the ropes off, but they give us the ability and the flexibility and freedom that now we have a chance to do the work on ourselves and such. So by being in association with sadhus, then we get exposure to all of these things that help to sever some of the ropes. And by being in association with this, the culture of bhakti, now the senses that are always looking for some stimulation and gratification, they are more controllable because they're engaged. You think about it, when we're just pursuing reading, we're engaging the mind and the intellect somewhat. But what about the other senses? If they're not engaged in Krishna, they're going to be engaged in something else. That's why the scholars, sometimes we have scholars who know all of the, they know the languages that some of the great texts are in, and they're reading works about Jiva Goswami and Baladeva, the Vijiva San, and Vishnu Chakravarti. I mean, they're reading these wonderful writings and poems and reading about the history of these great persons and teaching it. But at the same time, they smoke, they drink, they womanize, engage in all kind of vulnerable things. Because even though they know the language and they speak the pastimes, and these things are very purifying, but because they're not engaged in the other senses, they really don't change much. Because some of these people are fallen Brahmins in previous lives also. It's like it's not just a normal, mundane, ordinary person, ordinary sense gratifier, who makes a life and a career in studying the writings of Jiva Goswami. It's not an ordinary person who's studying, you know, the great poems, you know, of Jiva Goswami, or the history of Vishnu Chakravarti. And they're just going to places Vishnu Chakravarti lived, and things he did, and teaching this. So they're thinking about him. They teach about it constantly. So even though now they're eating meat and smoking and all this stuff, in many cases, some of these people were internally directed to do this kind of work. Because in a previous life, they were connected in some ways, but were deviants. In previous lives, they were not up to par. So they still have a certain interesting quality, and they have ability to get some blessings by having to remember and speak about some of these wonderful things. So this can happen to the smarter brahmanas, for instance. Is that in the previous life, somebody's doing too many yajnas and havanas and things, so they're connected with Vedic culture. They take birth in the West or someplace, but still they have this fascination with India, fascination with Govardhan Hill, fascination. Last lifetime, they were a sannyasi who deviated, fell down in Braj, and so they were like now sentenced to a body in the West to undergo this kind of lifestyle based on some desires in the past. But still, this sukriti from previous life is still a part of their consciousness and part of their spiritual bank account. So instead of going so far away to become an atheist or some other type of impersonalist or whatever, they now are spending so much of their working hours studying very amazing things, but it only settles in the mind and only to the level of intelligence. And therefore we don't see a change in character sufficiently, or when they are becoming practitioners. What are the differences between karma yoga, jnana yoga, indirect devotional service, and direct devotional service? Well, the Chaitanya Maharaj alluded to it in one of the questions he was answering the other day, when there was a question about mixed devotion. And so our devotion gets tinged. I was mentioning about the sweet rice, huh? And the sand in it. So the devotion, it can have this also. We can be engaged in devotion, but it can be mixed with the sand of karma yoga. Too much interest in fruitive things. Devotion is there. So I can be a Vaishnava, but they can have so much more focus in fruitive kind of things, and that contaminates, you know, the devotion. Now one can be a bhakta, but then they are too much involved in jnana yoga. Bhakti is mixed with jnana. And so they're more interested in what they can know rather than what they can become. We're interested in, sometimes you find devotees like that. They don't know just that. They read all kind of books, but then they can't chant 16 rounds. Sometimes you even find some devotees, they can do so many yajnas and pujas and they even know Sanskrit nicely, but they can't chant 16 rounds. They can't, not that they can, but they won't. Which means that they're kind of trying to enjoy Krishna consciousness rather than really be a proper devotee. Or sometimes one just wants to be around the spiritual master. They want to enjoy rather than going out and doing some service, doing some work. And that can happen. No, it's not. The chanting is calling for service, and getting an association of guru to get instructed about how to work on your life and change your life. And so that instruction is, of course, not just in Navapu, it's not so much there, but in Navani. And we see that so many times great devotees not even have so much association, you know, with their spiritual master. Prabhupada didn't have a whole lot of association with his guru much. He wasn't always around him so much. But he took to heart what the instructions were. You see, even the Goswamis, they weren't with Lord Chaitanya that much. But when they were, it was quality association. Even there are some present devotees in ISKCON who are spiritual masters, who never actually talk with Srila Prabhupada. Never had too much personal connection, other than a couple of times in the class, when Prabhupada was giving a class, and they were part of the audience, but they didn't travel with them, or get direct instructions. But still, they're dedicated, and they've been making the disciples themselves, on the order, the Prabhupada. But they didn't have, even one time to be able to just talk with Prabhupada or to, ask a personal question. And still they're quite serious. And there are others who travel with Prabhupada, were secretaries, were servants, and they fell down. Or became, deviant even a short time after Prabhupada left. So it's not how many days and how much we're with the guru and like that, but it's the quality of the association, the quality of accepting the instructions, being able to use it. Now, at the same time, we do have to admit that especially in Kali Yuga, we have to be more conscientious when we select a guru, because we also have to be able to feel accountable to that spiritual master, and we have to be able to see how we can somehow facilitate his mission. And it doesn't mean we have to leave and go and be where our spiritual masters are, but that we have to realize we take a spiritual master, we're also making some commitment to be a part of his vision of preaching or part of his spiritual family, etc. So sometimes it can be difficult if we don't see the guru sometimes, if we're not around the guru. We can feel forsaken, we can feel unconnected, we can become irresponsible or not accountable. Or we can even become impersonal and sort of enjoy the fact that, oh, my guru doesn't come, so therefore he's not going to really get on my case. Oh, my guru doesn't really know what I do every day, so I really can just not be so worried because he's so busy. So I won't ask him any questions. I won't try to understand his mode of service or what's expected of me. Just do what I do. And after all, I'm connected with the Parampara. So sometimes devotees do like that. Sometimes devotees, even with their guru, on a constant basis, and they're far away even though they're so-called, with the guru. Because they're just thinking, guru, guru on the wall, please give me blessings more than all. But give me blessings, but no service, no commitment. Don't be concerned about monitoring what I do, but just and send the blessings from afar. But then somebody's with the guru, and they're thinking, they're worshiping the guru, and they're serving the guru, but in the back of their mind, they're thinking, yep, one day, I'm going to be a guru. Let me study this guru, put my guru close, because one day, I'm going to be the guru. Even a better guru than my guru. Let me see. I'm going to be better than your guru soon, you'll see. Be very proud of me. I'm going to be very good. I'm going to learn what you do so I can use it for also having disciples and getting distinction, adoration, and profit. So, he missed the real point of service, dedication, and that one is supposed to even see any success that comes into their life is due to the mercy of their own guru. So then the proper guru never gives up being a disciple. Even when the spiritual master leaves the planet, that the best student is the best teacher. So guru is supposed to be the best disciple. Not that he's thinking, oh, I'm a guru. People may think that way toward him. But he is thinking, oh, I am a disciple. And because my guru is so kind, he sent me people to help to be able to offer more to him. Or the guru should think, my disciples are like manifestations of my own guru who has come in such form so I can relate to him in this way. But my disciples are arrangements that Krishna has provided so I can be able to take care and offer back to the spiritual master. But one is thinking, oh, this is my disciple, my property. You see how the Goswamis, they were so amazing how they would take care sometimes of different, jivas. But they did not have this unhealthy ownership. Sometimes someone would be sent, oh, you go and you study with Jiva Goswami. You go and you do service, for Raghunath. You go learn this from such and such. So it was a family in this way. So even though someone was a Diksha disciple or someone, that the Goswamis did not have any problem in one who was directly under their care now learning something from here, from there. Oh, but because there was this pure focus on Krishna, then Guru was more one in the sense that the instructions were there and the help was there. But even though we say Guru is one, or we say everybody, this one has a husband, she has a husband, and he has a wife, yeah, the husband is there and the wife is there. But still, you have a special relationship with your own husband, your own wife. You don't say, oh yeah, yeah, but I mean, husband and wife, it's okay. I'm merciful, kind, considerate, non-sectarian. And so maybe tomorrow I'll spend time with your wife. Some people do that in the West. They swap wives, swap husbands. They get kind of bored after a couple of weeks, you know, they've been married. They think, oh, okay. Now the fire is going out of his relationship. And, oh, the next door neighbor, fire is going out of your relationship also, okay. Then maybe I'll send my wife over to your house sometimes. You send your wife over to my house. And we have these little circles of interactions in this way. So call it friendship. We share our intoxication, our cigarettes. We share our wives also. And all parties are happy. Because the wife is thinking, yeah, I'm bored of this guy also. So I'm glad I can have some other relationships in my life. It makes it tolerable having to be with this man who I married, who I first had some great infatuation, and after the romance, sort of left out of the relationship, and then it's become work. He wants me to iron his clothes and starch his shirts and cook for him. He thinks I'm just some kind of slave. I need a life. So we change husbands and wives, and share our sadnesses and disappointments. How many types of sukriti are there? How can one accumulate the sukriti born of devotional service? But even though it answers, there are three types of sukriti: born of karma, sukriti born of jnana, sukriti born of bhakti. So these are like benefits and credits that are connected with karma, with jnana, and with bhakti. The first type, sukriti, enjoys the fruits of one's karma. The second type, one attains liberation. And the third type, one develops firm faith and unalloyed devotional service. Performance of the limbs of devotional service about one's knowledge is called sukriti, born of devotional service. So here we're talking about the person getting benefits without even being so knowledgeable and aware of it. So someone can get benefits based on karma. And so they've done some pious things, good things. And they get some things in reciprocation, some things because of that. And then someone, due to knowledge, so it shows you that knowledge does give gives benefit. So somebody who maybe in last lifetime were just reading Vaishnava texts, now in this, later in their life, or later in the next life, now that person becomes a right-on, full-time Sri devotee, engaged in direct service, you know, for the temple or in the congregation. But that was due to the accumulation of something in the past for giving donations to devotees, reading the books, helping sponsoring some kinds of preaching programs, some projects. So from that, one gets credits to come to a point in the next life where they can actually participate in devotional service of themselves. What is the difference between bhajan and shadow in Spajan? Since we have ecstasy and also shadow ecstasy, what's the difference? They both seem to be the same thing. They look like the same thing. They give some reflections of the same. Like shadow ecstasy, one actually can experience some outer state of consciousness, some bliss,
But sometimes the shallow ecstasy comes when one is in the association of a rather advanced or pure person, pure devotee. By being in touch with that purity coming from that pure person, then that person gets some of that devotion spills over and they experience it. But it's like temporary. Or sometimes some shallow ecstasy is that Krishna reaches out and gives, Krishna reaches out and gives the person some taste, some initial stimulation. It's like when many devotees first join, they got some interesting taste at first. It's Krishna's enticement. It's like in the case, you know, of Narada Muni, when he saw Krishna, and then Krishna let him know, you'll never see me again in this lifetime, but go on, don't worry. You are on the right path, just continue. So sometimes Krishna gives us some kind of experience that lets us feel more comfortable that we are connected and doing the right thing. But now we have to persevere and continue. And then we have that experience ongoing. So this shallow ecstasy is like that. That is giving us a glimpse of what's possible. We get some initial contact with some of the higher mellows and involvements. But it's just an enticement of what is available as we able to go deeper. So let's see what Bhaktivinoda, how he answers this. The following statements are offered to the neophyte Vaishnavas who practice chanting, Namabhas. Even if one worships Krishna with various material desires, he will still attain perfection in devotional service. Because the Namabhas can gradually integrate into pure chanting. By worshipping Krishna to fulfill one's material desires, one attains the mellows of devotional service to Krishna. Quote, if an ambitious person worships Krishna, then even though he does not desire pure devotion, Krishna will still lie on the surface, lotus feet. The word bhajan in the context refers to the unrelenting sadhana practiced by those who are almost Vaishnava. Just as we say, devotees, but we're really in preparation to become, you know, devotees. We're trying to become devotees. We're not pure fully yet. So we are trying to become Sudha-bhaktas, unmotivated, uninterrupted servants of the Lord. But real bhajan lies in the favorable cultivation of Krishna consciousness without the desire for sense gratification, fruitive activities, or mental speculation. Read that again. So real bhajan lies in the favorable cultivation of Krishna consciousness without the desire for sense gratification. One, fruitive activities. Two, mental speculation. So becoming fixed in foremost bhajan means we cannot engage in having some fruitive desires. Krishna, I will do this service, do that service, I'll just do that. But Krishna, I'll do that because I want you to do this for me. I worship you, but you have to find me a good husband or a good wife. I worship you, but you know you should help me to become a powerful entrepreneur where I make a lot of money. And after I make a lot of money, I even turn around and I'll give you some little bit, you know, to help with the food for life. Why, I'll build a little temple for you somewhere. So you let me win the lottery or become a multimillionaire in my enterprise. So this fruitative concerns will not give us true Krishna consciousness. Nor will mental speculation. We are involved, but we don't have strong faith. We're thinking more and more of being inquisitive or curious. So we're not happy by just the ongoing normal life of deviation and sense gratification. And we're thinking, so let me try this God stuff for a while. I'll go and visit the Hare Krishnas, stay with them for a couple of months. Then I'll visit in the Brahma Kumaris, and then I'll go do a little Kundalini yoga, and then I'll do, you know, a little Reiki or mixing in here there, and I'll do this, that thing, study. I'll do astrology, and somehow I'll find my niche. So they're not really trying to think how to surrender to serve the senses of Krishna. They're looking in one terms of, let me find some way to be able to get some sense gratification in a pious way. What does it mean for a householder to control the urge of his genitals? But even though it says, to have sex with one's legitimate wife is called controlling the urge of the genitals. Take one or two more here. Can foodstuff cook by non-devotees, or if we are not also hearing and chanting, then it's only a matter of time that Maya is going to engulf us like really intense. We have to realize that the process must be honored in the proper way. Otherwise, we cheat ourselves. We think, oh, okay, so let me just chant one or two rounds and I'll go to my room and I'll sleep. And I'll tell people I'm chanting, but everybody knows. Everyone knows. If you're a devotee more than 6 months, you know somebody goes to their room doing japa day after day after day, that they ain't absorbed in chanting the holy name in their room and sleeping. Because when you're really chanting, you have a certain mood, there's certain things that as you do them right, there's a certain level of consciousness that's associated with that, certain habits. So we have habits that are not nourishing the creeper, then it's a sign that we're cheating ourselves. We should be happy to be able to be caught in Krishna's name and be around others who are caught in Krishna's name. We should be happy, be wanting to hear the class so we can internalize that message as we move out, and doing different things. And we see when devotees no longer have interest in coming to the programs, they miss the chance to rise early to be able to absorb in the more important hours. As preachers, you stay out late sometimes, but it shouldn't be like every night, every night, every night. Then one never gets a chance to be able to have more systematic chanting, systematic reading. And times when there's a shortage of manpower, we can all be in the class, but it shouldn't be like it's a habit that we just want to avoid classes. And we come to a class, grudgingly, okay, I got it short. So I will come to the class, but in my mind I'll be thinking all of the kind of stuff while the class is going on. You heard 5 minutes something that was said, and then the mind went off some other place. The devotees are expert. There's some devotees who can sleep with their eyes open. I listen to devotees in New York City, New York and the New York Temple, who can sleep standing up. Unbelievable. There's always an expert about getting to sleep. So, let's read the one or two last ones here. Only foodstuff cooked by pure devotees should be offered to Krishna. Non-devotees and pseudo-devotees should not be present while the Vaishnavas are worshipping Krishna. So that means that when we, for first class pukka service, we should be very even careful of what the atmosphere is like, right? Is that devotees should not be cooking food while you have, karmas, lusting over the food. Because then it becomes contaminated, not a pure offering of such. And so it becomes hard sometimes. People are living at home and they are living with relatives, who are not Vaishnavas. If you're not careful, you're cooking something, they come and take something out of the pot, or they're looking and watching. And so we have our environment such that the kitchen is like a temple also. That for devotees, again, the culture to involve ourselves in not just the philosophy, but in the whole experience involving our senses. So therefore, even cooking, we're thinking first how to prepare this so we can prepare this for Krishna. He will take it first. And we're excited that we can be able to do this personal service by cooking, and we must be in a clean environment, keep things tidy, because it's Krishna's kitchen. Even our rooms, we should keep tidy. We should realize, hey, it's not my room, this is Krishna's room. I'm the caretaker. Our cars, we should keep clean and tidy. We should think, this is not just something I'm using for going to work or going to Sankirtan or going to the store. It's actually equal to Krishna has provided. This is the property of the deity. When you think about that, it's a powerful way of bringing and having stronger community. When we do all of our services, but all of our services in the spirit, that this is service for the deity. So if I'm doing treasury, I think this is Krishna's Lakshmi. If I'm cleaning the yard, I think this is Krishna's yard. And we want to make it nice, landscaping or whatever, clean, so people will be uplifted as they come into Krishna's temple. We are doing catering, we are doing Sikujoy work, and so each devotee is thinking, this is Krishna's property, Krishna's service that we have a chance to do. Then one will be more honest, thoughtful, compassionate, and more exact in being freed of the mishras, the karma, bhakti, karma, yoga, you know, jnana mishra. Realize not only is Krishna watching, monitoring in the heart and so many other ways, but this is really his service. And then each devotee is thinking that way. You know, have so much love amongst each other, thinking, oh, you're doing Krishna's service, and you're coming this angle, this area, and I'm doing Krishna's service, and I'm doing like this, this person's doing Krishna's service. Then devotees have great appreciation for each other's services, great appreciation for each other, and will create an environment that will create more, you know, teamship. We see this, you know, if you have a good sports team, or, you know, you have a band, or an orchestra. This stuff is really outstanding. It's not because there's just a few outstanding people. It's all one or two people working really hard. It's because you have people who do their own individual thing nicely, and they smile doing that thing nicely, then all those nice things add up. And you have, like, powerful sports team, because you have powerful individuals who now make up that team. You have a wonderful band or orchestra because you have some people who are quite good and somebody else is doing what they're doing. Otherwise, you have somebody who's a good team, who's good into sports, but he's not a team player, or somebody who doesn't do their work at all. And so the person who doesn't do their work, they kind of sabotage the rest of the team because they become a weak spot in the team. So the team is as good literally as the individual players. Each temple is as strong as the devotees are. Now that means if you have so many devotees who don't chant, don't come to programs, then those devotees like make the team weak. Or if you have some devotee who like only reads and to themselves, but somehow they don't share, then it also makes the team weak because that person has much to share that they can share in order to be able to help others. Such ways. But then it's also true that devotees have different propensities. So those propensities, the beauty, if they can be encouraged based on those propensities as much as possible, then they can offer more. So somebody is very reprimandical, but they kind of have to do vaishya work all the time. They will do it, you know, unless they're totally pure, they will do it. But they will not feel they have the same enthusiasm? Or would they give the same quality of service? Because they're repressing some of what their own talents. Or someone, you know, is more the Vaishya oriented, but then they are boxed into what they have to do for joy work, you know, for medical work. But it's not really, it's their nature so much. Then they'll do it kind of grudgingly. They'll do it because it has to be done. But they won't advance as much, or what they offer as much, you know, to community, because they're only doing it, you know, mainly out of duty. But now the difficulty, of course, that we have in most temples, that we have a shortage of manpower. And because of the shortage of manpower, then we kind of have to have the devotees do, you know, whatever the call of service is. And as we do that, you know, that's okay for a while. But if somebody really is more brahminically a student, a preacher, and they have to, you know, clean the yard every day, then after a while, they're going to think, I think I'll go somewhere else. I think I'll do something else. Someone, say, is more of a minimal type, and they really enjoy and appreciate and feel excited in doing deity service. Then you have to go out and you know, and collect every day. Then they'll do it. But then one day they'll think, I can't do this anymore. And maybe Maya might, you know, may attack them. So the dynamic is that it's important for the leader to try to see best how to engage people, you know, based on their propensities. But at the same time, it's important for the devotee to be ready to do whatever the call of service is. So it's almost like a contradiction. The devotee should be thinking, oh, how can I do whatever service you know, is necessary? But they should try to see as much as possible how to engage people, you know, based on their propensities. Otherwise, if everybody's just thinking, well, you heard the class, you heard the verse, you heard what Maharaj said. Maharaj said, you should do what feels good for you, what works for you. So for what works for me, Prabhu, is that I should take out the tray of the maha every day. And I'll clean the trays and that's it, after I eat all the food of the maha. And for you, if you like to go out on Harinam, if you like to, you know, go out on book distribution, if you like to preach to other people, then you do that. But, you know, me, I don't like people so much. I'm introverted. And so I don't really think it's necessary because it doesn't work for me. You go and tell somebody something about Krishna. I don't like to do that. But you like to give yourself talk. So you... So people would just justify all kind of whatever and make it not a team. But the beauty is that when there are differences, that devotees have different talents, and they can be somehow encouraged based on that in general, while at the same time jumping in, you know, to do the call of, you know, the call of service in that way. Any questions or any comments?
If you're studying Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, and Prabhupada books, but you're not living what you're studying, is that considered to be an offense against the Holy Name?
Well, even worse, it's an offense against your own devotional life, because it minimizes, you know, all the angas of bhakti. And that reading is very powerful, very important. We're reading to understand about how to have, you know, proper behavior. We're reading to understand by tuning into others of proper behavior, so we can try to emulate them. And so if we read to find out, it's like you take a cookbook. So we have so many nice cookbooks. You open the cookbook and you read how to make something, then you close it and you do something else. So open, I'm going to make something really nice. You look at the cookbook, you see how to make this preparation, then you close it and you just start, you know, engage in speculation. Just do that. And you say, well, what happened to the prep? I read what's supposed to happen. But it didn't work out. Because after reading, you didn't act upon it. So somebody thinks, I read. But why am I becoming more of a devotee? Because you're not following. You know what you're reading. So then one is kind of wasting time almost. You're not going to follow what's in the cookbook. Then don't even pretend. Say, today I'm going to go in the kitchen and I'm going to make something. Speculate. Say, well, let's see what it's like. But for Krishna, we of course want to have more clarity about what we're doing. Or something will cook like that. they just speculate. They say, well, this is something very special. And something was actually so good that once they've learned basically how to cook things, then they can be very innovative because they've learned the basics, and now they can do something very exotic and interesting. But then after they've learned the basics, but then somebody going doesn't have the basics, and they poison you pregnant with what they've cooked. So devotional service is like that also. So after we've really learned the basics, we've become that, then one grace into the Raghunuga platform. But that means after. It doesn't mean that one goes there first. That's obvious. And so once the artist or like once a musician has learned and mastered the instrument so well, then he or she doesn't have to be confined the song of the orthodoxy, because it's just such a natural part of them. But we try to go outside of that without the adhikara, and it causes a disturbance. Somebody says, well, I don't really have to chant because, that's for new devotees. You'd be surprised. Some people maybe preach it sometimes. You have to do that, because when you first join, you just get recently away from marijuana and from other kinds of drugs, and so you need to clear your mind by chanting Hare Krishna every day. But for me, I don't have to do that because I'm always thinking of Krishna. You become advanced like me, you don't have to worry. Like, but we understand that it's bogus because Rupa Goswami makes devotion, Hare Bhakti Vilasas, mentions even when one has come to the platform of purity, still for the benefit of others, one should still go on following these things because it encourages others. And so one should not even just act spontaneous in public arrangements because it can bring on confusion. So we see how Prabhupada didn't have the chin arguments. He didn't have the chin rounds. But he did. We chin for the benefit of us. Any other questions?
According to Rupa Goswami, in the next of instruction, he says that because this is a complicated emotional affair, dissipate ignorance and simple reaction. I just wonder, when he is serving good emotional service, simple reaction in the present state tend to disappear. But why not disappears also in the future reaction of emotional service? We see in a situation that people may stay 10 years or more, but still gain back his old style, flesh style.
Yeah, because he's not doing pure devotional service. That's because the devotional service is mixed. Or the devotional service is with too many weeds, and offenses. It's like why the gardener who has planted the seeds and is watering the crop, why so many of the crop dying? Because while he's also has planted the seeds and watering, yes, the weed also. Because the weeds have a way of taking also the water. And they grow. See, sometimes The creeper is growing, but the weed has not been poured out. And so the weed, that it can be quite small at first, but the same water, because the weed is wild, is growing the creeper some, but if the weed isn't taken out, the weed gets stronger and stronger. When the weed gets stronger and stronger, then at some point, you know, it chokes the creeper. That's why you can find some devotees, they go along for quite a while. But if they don't sort of be more authentic and really taking close inventory with what was happening in their lives, then they have these bad patterns that stay. And even when they're sometimes called out on it, they become angry or disturbed, or they justify. And then that weed gets stronger. And then at some later time, that same weed that was there becomes so strong that it chokes the creeper. We wonder, how is it that the devotees served for 10 years, 15 years, and now, you know, they become so antagonistic, or now they're just, you know, having a job outside where they're almost, you know, never coming to programs, not associating, in some cases not even chanting. And that happens because of the weed. That's why when I was mentioning about, yesterday how, in the verse of reading was just amazing, because it was explaining this point, you know, in contrast to what can manifest when the devotion is not proper, or when the activity is not proper. And Purport Prabhupada was saying yesterday in the Bhagavatam class, it's not even the leader, because the leader has more involvement in whatever happens, more involvement to facilitate, sometimes more involvement to get some bad reciprocation. So leadership is very dangerous in this sense. It's like being a parent is very dangerous because you're in a more, you know, dominant position. You can really help the child, you can abuse the kid. So, the Prabhupada was saying how one can go into a coma and even come back in a body that's not even a human body. So therefore, when one is in the devotional service, if they're not being consistent in taking out the weed, then, you know, puna musiko bhava. Once again, the other person becomes a mouse. And we've seen enough of that year after year that it should scare the average devotee to be more careful. But because there's so many ways that takes, you know, so many things for granted. Especially if we're self-righteous. And when we lack greater appreciation for others. See, so much of Maya, in terms of like Vaishnava offenses or aparadha, lack of etiquette, really means that we think too much of ourselves and not enough of others. Doesn't mean that we should think less of, we should have low self-esteem. But we should think a little more of others. We think more of others, we're just kind of more careful about how we deal with people. We don't think so much about other people. We don't mind, you know, just using them according to our own plan. And that can present an actual problem. We mentioned how the guru was even to think, even though the guru's duty, for instance, is to use, you know, the disciples, to engage them. But even the guru was just thinking, this is my disciples. We have some block in their own devotional life. They must be considering, this is a chance for me to serve my guru. Or this is a chance for me to see how to be a catalyst for organizing the bhakti. So Krishna is sending me more facility to be able to organize the present to him. Otherwise it becomes another kind of unhealthy, you know, type of proprietorship. This is mine. Sometimes devotees, you know, they even write, this is such and such book in the care, this book in the care of such and such. Sometimes devotees do that. It's like kind of nice to think. So even my literature, really I'm the caretaker of this. My car, I'm the caretaker of this. My house, I'm the caretaker. Now the question is, and the concern, if my house or my flat, I'm the caretaker of it, then it means that the real owner must be glorified. That the real owner must, what the real owner deserves and desires must be prominent. So if my house belongs to Krishna, then Krishna doesn't accept any meat, doesn't accept any intoxications, doesn't accept any cigarettes, so we don't have that stuff in our house. And so therefore we're showing that, you know, he's actually the owner. When we come into the house, we see different things that remind us of who the owner is. Who the owner is. Any other questions? Yeah, that does happen. It happens. And that's why a good foundation is important also. See, some devotees have so much trouble later in their Krishna consciousness because really they start off on a bad foundation. They start off on a foundation that wasn't very strict. And that doesn't show so much at first. I was explaining in Durban how, I think it was Durban, how, even here I mentioned that, so, how Krishna consciousness gets more, you know, more complex as we go on. It's like in the university, the knowledge is more complex. But if you have had a good background in the basics, then when you go to the university, it's not, you know, it's not so difficult. But some people who didn't study so nicely, didn't learn, you know, test skills, study skills very well, thought they were getting away. But then later, it hurts them. Because now the higher subject matter they have to deal with is based on the other prior knowledge that they should have. And so, each time a devotee gets a position and they're given mercy or responsibility, then if somehow their foundation wasn't so substantial, later their problems begin to surface more. And where when they were, you know, newer devotee, it didn't show quite as much. But if they have more influence, responsibility, and facilities, then that weed begins to come out even more. And that is again why it's so important that we keep trying to become even more humble as we get more opportunity. See, like if I got about 1,000 disciples still around the world. If I have 10,000, 100,000 disciples, I also would then have to become that much more humbled. If I'm having some success here or there, and I start getting more and more, you know, success, if I don't become even more humble than I was previously, that same more success will turn into my downfall. Some way of analyzing it. If I'm going to be receiving more from you, so you're going to give me some things. But now, if I already got so much already in my hands, in order to receive more, I have to now free myself to be able to receive more of what's coming. And so as Krishna is giving more, one has to become more humble, you know, not less. But see, Maya's trick is that when a person gives more responsibility, more facility, more finance, whatever, then sometimes the individual begins to think even more that they're the controller. And then that extra becomes an overload. They can't handle it. When I mentioned about the Buddhist here, and one devotee asked, I think it was Bhakti Matthew, about, you know, the difference between the Majjham, Uttama Majjham, you know, and Kanishtha. Maharaj spoke so nicely. And I shared some small point about Shraddha, about faith. Are really the major aspect of these categories is based on the quality of faith. And then I shared how, like, the Uttama is totally dependent upon Krishna. And it's such a puppet that then there's no interference. Krishna's using the person even more. So they have so much faith in Krishna's arrangement, they make themselves totally at the mercy and available. And so because of that, so much power happens. So the from the Madhya to the Kanishtha, they are more dependent on themselves or more dependent on other things. But the Uttama, the pure devotee, is fully dependent. And so therefore we see that with real evolution and acceleration, then one has to be more dependent on Krishna. Otherwise, you know, there'll be a problem. I was mentioning to one of the two of the leaders in Durban, I said, I can see, because I study things social, psycho-religious. So to me, these things like very clear. I said, I can see that in some cases, some brahmacharis who are doing very nice now, but when they become sannyasis, they'll fall down. Because what weed is there, or what they have is brahmachari, that can maintain them. Now they get additional, you know, position, and additional mercy. Unless they are able to make a shift in their brahmachari consciousness, a deeper connection, that, you know, there'll be a problem. Or you can have someone who can be a good devotee, but that person becomes a treasurer, becomes a temple commander, and she becomes the president, they'll totally change. Because that kind of responsibility will not be good for the ego, will cause them to be less dependent and less respectful to other Vaishnavas. It'll cause them to be less sensitive, you know, to their own sadhana, and then become president, then they fall. There's some devotees who were doing good at first, and then you make them a leader, a president or something. And all of a sudden it's like, they're the same person. And you come back 2 years later and you think, what happened to the person? Used to be so eager to do service, used to study a lot, used to chant nicely, come to class, used to do that. And now, what happened? And in some other cases, the person gets opportunity, and they really come up to the call. When the leaders in Durban were having a discussion on Suradhamma, I had a workshop or a seminar, somewhat of an interactive discussion with some of the leaders on standards for initiation. How to kind of focus a little clearer on what are the standards, for the zone, for the yasha. And we were saying how sometimes a devotee is a little bit of a risk case. And you give them initiation, and instead of getting better, they go down. So they think, just see, I'm okay, I knew I was okay all along. Or they lose the impetus trying to, you know, come up to something. But then sometimes, someone has a little bit of risk case, and you give them initiation, and they feel, to be even more accountable. They realize, I wasn't really fully qualified. I got this opportunity. Now let me really show my appreciation, or let me come up, you know, to the standard. And they get enthused, I'm going to say motivated, you know, to become more serious. And so it's not always so easy to decide which is the best for such a person who is not quite clearly on standard, up to standard. And so with initiation, encourage a person to have more determination now, or what it calls the individual, you know, to feel more comfortable. Because we always have a larger number of devotees who have to take an initiation, then they start getting, you know, slack. Because it's like, okay, I got the certificate now. I'm in the company, I'm here now. So then they put their guards down and they stop. You're having the same kind of intensity. And therefore we have to give a little more emphasis to ourselves as gurus as we do give initiations to remind the congregation especially that you are to see the temple as your soul is how to have some service, you know, that's connected with the temple. Initiation is not just that you have a guru and now you're connected and you don't somehow take up some of the burden of responsibility. You don't see how to make some sacrifices. But it means you are accepting an identity is with a guru, with a new name, but with a project also, in your immediate place, immediate area, that you should see the deities as your yesterday, but and see how to do some service, such ways. Any last question? Yeah. So will we next few days continue on some of the points, you know, the discussions that Bhaktivinoda brings up, and his amazing answers on different things. His God found the child is divine grace. Esi Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada ki.
So it was born, it comes into the world already equipped with certain assets and also with certain debits. And now while in the womb, before even delivery, so many major aspects of that person's personality and consciousness is already formed. So now more and more entities are being born that start off with a tremendous debit, tremendous deficit. Because according to the consciousness of the man and the woman, when they meet for union, has a huge effect in the kind of presence that they call. And this is why in spiritual culture, there is the samskaras. And so every important life change was to be done with blessings and with proper understanding and to maximize the greatest benefit of that rites of passage. And so from Grabodan's samskara, from impregnation to delivery, the first grain taking, first hair cutting, first day going to school, to vivaha, to marriage, on to death. That all of these were activities that were major shifts in one's life and where one could get tremendous leverage and benefit by engaging in these things in the most dharmic, auspicious way. And where not, then there was some inauspicious consequences. And so now with so much abortion, now with so much lack of accountability and so much lust rather than love, then it does become harder for most entities that are born into this world to be able to take to a spiritual lifestyle. Because often, when they are born, they're already imbibing so much fear and hate and even anger. It's been projected toward them that they have picked up from the environment. And that's why we're finding more and more children who are extremely aggressive, attention deficit disorders, and even violent, and even sometimes murdering other children. How would you feel if somebody keeps inviting you to come into their home and every time you come they kill you or try to kill you? Then one day they try, you are invited to the house and now you can reside there. But you are still having so many impressions from the previous times. So some of these souls that are being aborted, then once they do find a womb where they can now, that entity can take birth, they have a lot of fears, anxieties, pains about the world that they're supposed to be able to function in a positive and progressive way. And so the world is getting very much populated by a lot of souls that have been abused by the ones who are supposedly to be their caretakers. Through abortion or through child abuse, incest, etc. center. So there's a need to be able to give more shelter and protection, guidance, facilitation to the youth. So the question is being asked, can young folk, children, can they actually take to spiritual life? Bhaktivinoda says, yes, by all means. And he gives the example, of course, of Prahlad, and he gives the example of Dhruva. So Prahlad and Dhruva Maharaj, they were very young. They were quite seemingly immature children. But at the same time, they were focused and determined and engaged in pursuits of glorifying Krishna and being fixed in spite of so many different issues. So Bhaktivinoda is saying, yes, yes, it is surely possible. But it is not only possible, a possibility, but it is a powerful opportunity, especially when such children are facilitated by dharmic parents. When such children are also wanted by how they are called into this world and they're not just an accident. So many living entities who are populating this planet, they're an accident. That was really up to the parents who have never been born. And you look at the number of children who were born, but after so many abortions, before they finally did find the chance to reside. And then these children who are born, how much violence they already pick up, anxiety and fear while in the womb. And then once they are small, then how much they undergo at these critical points in their life. So we can see that parenting is quite awesome. It's one of the most difficult duties one can engage in. At the same time, we see how important it is to give the children proper opportunity. And then they have this facility to then use their free will with hopes that they will take to the spiritual lifestyle and remain consistent. So if they're brought in, how things start have a big effect on often the outcome. How things are developed in their very tender time and stage has an effect. And then what that individual experiences in the environment obviously is very, very significant. Next question by Bhaktivinoda that's being asked to him. What are the primary and secondary differences in the process of bhajan? What harm can be caused by secondary differences? So he's asking, in spiritual life, in one's practice of one's siddhanta, one's rituals, and following one's vows, what are primary concerns and what is secondary? And where and how can the secondary concerns interfere or bring problems with the primary? Answer. The answer is from the Chaitanya, his Chaitanya Shikshamrita. As the human beings in this world gradually move from uncivilized to civilized, from civilized to scientific, from scientific to moral, and from moral to devotional, the process of worship, worshiping God, also changes according to the differences in what language, dress, food, and mental condition. If one considers this from an impartial viewpoint, one can understand that these secondary differences do not actually cause harm as long as there is not enmity in the process of bhajan. There'll be no problems at the time of perfection. So what Bhaktivinoda is saying that there are different qualities of what happens to people, different levels of evolution. There are the uncivilized and the civilized. There's from civilized to scientific, from scientific to moral, from moral to devotional. He said all of these different stages that individuals go to and civilizations go to produces a different kind of worship. And that he's saying that one should not get so distracted by these differences, because this is natural. There'll be different kinds of details connected with the differences. But he's also helping us understand that ultimately it's about Sharanagati, full surrender to the Lord. This will manifest in differences according to the details. And that these things that are secondary are not such a problem as long as we are clear in how they take place and how they come about and what they ultimately are there to bring forth. And he explains this in other places in what is called Artha-Prata versus Param-Artha-Prata. So the Artha-Prata are things that often can be considered to be secondary, or the Artha-Prata are things having to deal with material nature. That can be history. In other words, it could be anything that's even connected with spirituality, but it is part of the material environment. And so Bhaktivinoda says, such things are to be examined, to be evaluated, to see to what degree they're relevant for the present time, place, and circumstance. Pradesha Kalabhata. He says, even though it may or may not be directly connected with part of the spiritual culture, but if it is dealing with material considerations, then one has right and should take notice to see what is of value and what can be used based on the present needs, the present circumstances. And so these would be considered to be things that are secondary, that can be changed, can be adjusted, should be looked at to see what adjustments are necessary. Then there's the Param-Artha-Prata. Those are areas that are universal, eternal, and essential aspects of what constitutes being a devotee, a Vaishnava, that are essential to the development of the creeper of the soul. So Prabhupada was once asked, in different ways, but distinctly in one time, about how to understand the difference and how to know, because the acharya does change things, every acharya has changed, and every endeavor may be primary or may be secondary. Every situation may be one or the other. How to know to distinguish when to change, what can be changed, what cannot, what shouldn't be tampered with. Prabhupada said that takes intelligence, takes spiritual advancement. Because one can begin to change things just to be, you know, politically correct, or change things because it seems to be rational, that is functional for the moment, for the present time, but very short interval, and it could be a disturbance where things get watered down. But then at the same time, spiritual life is never wedged in stone, and that it's not just a matter of dogma, it's just not a matter of physicality or externals, it's a matter of Krishna's love being constantly able to come through, and for one able to be able also to give and to receive. And so the form and the means of propaganda may adjust in some ways, as long as it, what? As long as some secondary or details help to reinforce the primary, then they can be accepted, allowed, etc. But when such changes do not somehow enhance the essence in the primary, then it becomes maya and a distraction. So what you've noticed talking about, so now even in the form of, in the arena, you know, of worship, is that people worship, we know, in different modes, of material nature. The influence, a certain kind of worship that's in the mode of ignorance, some in the mode of passion, some in the mode of goodness. And there's certain types of worship that's connected with transcendence, but still connects us with different aspects of transcendence. That will take one to Vaikuntha, another to Vrindavan. Certain kind of worship allows us to think and accept and interact with God as a supreme autocrat, or to enter ultimately into a relationship of like parental, vatsalya, or friendship, neutrality, conjugal. And so a certain kind of environment of worship then will produce this if we, following it genuinely. So what you notice is all of that is natural. Just like some people may think, how can religion be true when there's so many different religions, so many different teachers, and they're saying different things? Well, that's part of the beauty of religion, is that people have so many different desires and different moods of intensity and wanting to know God. And so therefore the same Krishna arranges different systems and different ways how he can be known in part as well as in full, which shows how Krishna is reciprocating according to what's going on within ourselves. Next question is, what is the proof of advancement on the path of sadhana? So sometimes devotees want to know, how can I really know that I'm advancing? If you have to ask that question, you can better believe that you're not advancing too much. I can say, how can I be sure that I'm advancing? And so one may have these kinds of concerns. Or we may ask ourselves, how do I know that my thirst has been satisfied? How do I know that I am full when I was starving or very hungry? Well, you know when you have eaten something and the body is stronger, and you know when you've drunk something and you're not in just desperation or dying of thirst, you understand that you have gotten some reciprocation, that some food, some drink is there. So similarly, we can know that we're advancing when we're feeling more and more full and rather happy and complete with our spiritual commitment, spiritual life. We can know we're advancing. We have less desire for something that is unhealthy and more eagerness for the goal. We know we're advancing. We begin to take on more of the qualities of what the ultimate destination entails. We know that we're getting closer to a situation as we begin to see it. Still at a distance, but now we are beginning to see, sometimes hear, sometimes other senses are beginning to associate with that experience. And so this is a paramdhista navartate, that we do not just try to stop activities. We're not trying to avoid pleasure, but we're trying to engage in the transformation of accepting something higher while we reject something that's lower. And if we're constantly rejecting something that's lower, then we won't have room for that which is higher. Many, many years ago, when Srila Prabhupada was on the planet, we were having a pandal in India. Big tent, and so many people had come. And after Prabhupada spoke, then there was questions from a huge audience of people. So then one man stood up and very kind of excitedly was saying, oh yes, my mother, she has this wonderful relationship with Gopal Krishna. Krishna is a small child. And every night she puts out some sweets and some drink for the Lord. And in the day, it is in the daytime, morning, it is gone. So people look around and some of them are laughing. I can see somebody thinking, yeah, it was probably the rats that got it. But as people were chuckling, Prabhupada, he stopped them. And he said, yes, it is possible to have this personal kind of exchange and relationship with the Lord. That it actually is possible. But he said, but, and he began to explain. And so he was explaining how that someone who has interacted or met Krishna, the life will never be the same. That if one has that level of devotion and contact, then we will not see them engage in all kinds of sense gratification, because they are now absorbed and filled with higher knowledge and understanding. So we have something genuinely, then certain other things do not show or manifest. And we have something, then certain things are in accord to what we have. Somebody has billions and billions of dollars. They say they have. But then we find they have no car, they have no house, they have no bank account, they have no stocks. In no way do their life represent a life of wealth and opulence. And so from what is manifested, what is perceived, we can most likely consider they don't have this kind of wealth. So when someone is absorbed in love of God, then there's certain things they have, certain things they don't have. There's certain things that they are not eager to be about, or certain things they do not do, because they're fully absorbed in the higher connections in spirituality. So Prabhupada was then saying that if someone has genuinely had this kind of experience, then they would not just be engaged in sense gratification, all kinds of mundane types of concerns. And if they are, then this is a sign that really they're not really having that experience. So what Prabhupada was doing is two things. He was showing, one, that it is possible to have this personal experience. No, you shouldn't make the noise with the cars. That's not good. But at the same time, he was letting him know that if you do have this experience, that some special things are associated, you know, with your life in this way. Next question. So let's finish what Bhaktivinoda says on this. This is the same question. How do we have proof of the advancement of our sadhana? He says there are mysteries in the practice of sadhana. Transcendental knowledge, devotional service, and detachment from material objects increases simultaneously. So he's saying one of the mysteries in healthy, honest, genuine sadhana advancement is that one acquires transcendental knowledge. This is the verse, Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Yoga Yana Yatsiva Yana Chajoyoga. So when we engage in devotional service, there is Jitindriya, when the one becomes detached toward the mundane and controlling of the senses. And so when one is having more control of the senses, then this is a sign that the creeper is being watered nicely and one is advancing. And where Dai Sisi Goni Dai Ki. And when there is lack of control of the senses, then we realize that the person is still captured by, you know, by the vegas. Now he says, whenever we see a sadhaka revert to previous stages in his practice, it is to be understood that there is a fault at the root of the sadhana. You understand what that means? But you know what it's saying? When we see someone, we resort back to like bad habits. Somebody is now taking alcohol again, taking drugs. Somebody is engaged in some illicit affairs. Someone is taking, eating abominable things. Someone, you know, is being duplicitous. But you know, it says, this is a sign that there is some disturbance in the sadhana. That it is a, be understood, there's a fault in the root of the sadhana. In other words, there's a disturbance, there's some improprieties, some deviation at the core, you know, of one's dedication and also one's form of worship. Without the association of devotees and the mercy of the spiritual master, one cannot always be protected from the danger of misguidance. So, especially in Kali Yuga, it's so easy to be tricked, so easy to be misguided, so easy to fall prey to previous bad habits. So he's saying, without the blessings of the guru and protection by the high-level sadhus, one will fall prey. The next question that's answered is, what is gradual advancement? Then from his Chaitanya Shikshamriti, he's answering this also. The gradual levels of advancement are proper and certainly they're effective. In the beginning, one should lead a pious life by becoming fixed in the principles of Varnashram Dharma, meaning one should carry out their duty, prescribed duty, be ethical, be moral. When one is advanced, one can certainly lead a life of regulative devotional. One can certainly lead a life of regulative devotion. Finally, one can achieve perfection by engaging in loving devotional service to Krishna. So it's like he's saying, in the beginning stages, one must be very, very rigid and strict according to rules, regulations. It's natural. But then he says, at first one may do this out of just duty. We do the right thing because we are told to do it. We don't really have much taste, desire, realization, but we do it. But then, by doing the right thing, out of duty, gradually we begin to accept it, understand it, to appreciate it, and even later to enjoy it. And the same thing happens with the sinful things. If you think about it, most sinful, deviant things, people train themselves up in how to begin to accept it. Let's take an example. Some of you used to smoke, not anymore. So just think about, first time you smoked a cigarette, it's totally hellish. Those cigarettes, get all choked up, coughed up. Then later you learn how to. But at first, it was a problem. Some of you, not anymore, you used to drink, fermented drinks, whiskey, wine, just rotten drinks. And the most expensive wine and whiskey is the most rotten. Oh, special occasion. People have this mood. Special occasion. Let's bring out the very special wine. It's been rotten for 35 years. We're going to really honor this occasion. Very fermented. And so for many people, well, first time they took whiskey, alcohol, beer, anything, was so nasty. But then later they learned how to enjoy it, so-called. It was so nasty. So they learned how to accept these very vulnerable things. Now some children, because they have been pious in a previous life, some have been yogis, some have been devotees, and maybe some of you, the first time you were exposed to eating of meat and flesh, you didn't want it. They're children, small children, who really hate to eat
their flesh. But gradually they learn how to do it because this is what is presented to them. But some kids, they have a certain kind of karma, even though they're born situation where people, you know, are meat eaters. They really have to be almost forced to eat the meat. Then gradually they begin to accept it because they're told, unless you finish your food, you're not going to be able to go out. Unless you eat this, you're not going to be healthy. You have to do this, do that. And so they get trained how to gradually accept the deviation. When children are very small, they are so philosophical. Everything they want to know. How, why, when, where. There's all these questions. Little child is small. This is small. Just beginning to talk and to understand things a little better. They always ask, Mommy, what is that? Who is this? Why? And then they ask these kind of questions, huh? Why is it raining? Why is it cold? Why that ball up there? Sun. But what is the sun? And who put it up there? And why is it there? There's all these deep philosophical questions. And you say, why she has long hair and I have short hair? Well, she's a girl. But why? Because you're a boy. But why? Why am I a boy? They ask all these deep questions. But they are trained by the environment to stop asking such questions. The child asks the mother, asks the father, rather. The father says, don't you see, I'm busy. Ask your mother. And then the little kid goes and asks, Mommy, why that's up there like that? The son, why? And the mother says, go ask your big brother. And then the kid goes and asks her brother. And the brother says, here you come again. Why? How? When? Why do you ask all these questions? And then he says, go ask your sister. And the sister says, get out of here. And the kid learns to not to think so deeply. That if you have all these deep concerns and questions, and you're very inquisitive, that it is not what people are to do. You're just supposed to just accept and act and don't try to understand. You just do, like everybody else is doing. So then the child gradually learns how we say, pashanapi napashati, how to see, but, you know, but not to see, not to inquire. So we should not stifle the creativity and the inquiry of the children. And so when they ask questions, and we shouldn't ask questions, sometimes when children are growing up and their parents and those around them are giving all this kind of, you know, baby talk. What language is that? Oh, look at the little child. Oh, isn't she so cute? Challenge the kid of opportunity. Talk to them. And again, even before they're born, talk to the child in the womb. Let them know that you love them, you care about them, you're ready to receive them. Even while the baby's in the womb, you read to the child. Because already the personality is being formed. And you're giving them a head start in this rough world that they're going to experience and such. And so, in this way, so many things that we're all about has to do with the kind of environment that we're constantly, you know, exposed to. We learn to be ethical, moral, or we learn how to, you know, to lack integrity. The father says, teaches the child that you shouldn't drink, you shouldn't smoke. But then the father is smoking and drinking. As we were saying the other day, so then the kid is accepting, oh, you can only smoke and drink when you become a big person. And so, when I become a big person, then I will drink and I'll smoke. But now, father says he can't do that. But he does that. So therefore, it has to become, you know, a big person. And so, in that sense, then we want to help them to understand based on our example. Then they realize, yeah, drinking, smoking, these kind of things are not healthy because mommy and daddy, you know, they don't do those things. And therefore, it's not something that I should emulate, follow, etc. Next question. So what is gradual advancement? The gradual levels of advancement are proper and certainly effective. In the beginning, one should lead a pious life by becoming fixed in the principles of Varna Ashram Dharma. When one is advanced, one can certainly lead a life of regulative devotion. Finally, one can achieve perfection by engaging in loving devotional service to Krishna. So again, in the beginning, you may do some things out of duty because, you know, it's necessary. But then gradually, we also can be reconditioned or learn to accept the good and then to want the good and then to enjoy doing the things, you know, that are in fact good. Just like now, we are chanting on our japa mala, chanting Hare Krishna. We take prasadam. We read spiritual books. So sometimes we're doing these things sort of out of duty. But now, if say tomorrow, that we ask you, tomorrow, I want everyone who's in here to give, to give away anything they have that's connected with Krishna consciousness. I want everybody here tomorrow to bloop. No involvement in anything that have to do with the culture of devotion. No taking prasadam, no chanting rounds, no seeing the deities, no reading books, no wearing Vaishnava clothes, no talking about Krishna, no associating with devotees. Stop it all. Come on, everyone. You realize how much we have accepted aspect of transcendental culture, how much we are identifying, even at this neophyte stage, with the process of ultimate liberation. Just like now, you may struggle sometimes with your rounds, but now, what if you could not ever chant on your beats? What if you could not, now that you, you're in your situation where you have no opportunity to read any spiritual transcendental books anymore? It would be total hell. So actually we do or are having certain tastes. Maybe not the highest tastes, but already we're having a serious taste to so many things that are connected with devotional service. Because if, in fact, that you could not chant, you would really miss the opportunity for chanting japa. If you could not read and hear anything about Krishna, you would really feel serious emptiness in your life. So we have integrated much more of the culture of bhakti than often we, you know, we realize. Or just imagine walking into this temple room. There's no pictures connected with anything with Krishna consciousness. You know, and there's no deities. You would feel totally different. Even though it's the same room, but you would feel disturbed. You would feel so incomplete. Walking into the very same room, but there's no deities. And there's no pictures and paraphernalia related to Krishna. Which means how much we are identifying with such, and how much we are having an alignment, affiliation, and appreciation. You take the wonderful, you know, temple in Durban, beautiful deities of Sri Sri Radhanath and, you know, Gauranga. But you have that nice temple room, and you take the deities out. Totally different. So there's so many things that are part of our life that we take for granted. Now, one day, if we're not careful, we can lose so much of that. We can take it for granted and just kind of hang out and just avoid the association of Vaishnavas, or begin to have most of our friends, people who have nothing to do with spiritual life. We can lose all of these things that are so special, or they can be taken away. So we don't want to starve our mala, our japa bead, japa bag, japa beads, by not accessing them. We don't want to go day after day after day without, you know, reading and hearing. We don't want to go week after week and we have to eat abominable things, or we have to, and we're not able to have food stuff that's been sanctified. But that can happen if we take things for granted. Because there are so many people who have had that opportunity and they've lost it. And there are many times that we don't really appreciate something significantly until we don't have it. It's so easy to get, you know, sort of familiar or mechanical, and then one day it's not there. Just like, say, someone just takes so much for granted that the wife is cooking the food and doing the cleaning, and then one day he goes to a different place or she goes somewhere, and now he has to be in the house. Then he realizes, hey, this is not such an easy thing. Doing the laundry, cooking, cleaning the house. Now I say, one day she goes to visit somewhere, or she's in the hospital, or maybe she's a professional, and so she goes on a trip. And so now he's at home, and it's his duty to take care of the children, to dress them, take them to school. It's his duty to arrange for their lunch. It's his duty to see that they're okay. And he realizes, wow, this is really overwhelming. He tells the kids, put on your clothes. And they're so small, they need help. And he has to do that. He has to then cook the food for them. He has to dry them. And he realizes, boy, I really miss my wife. He calls her. You love it. When are you coming home? Everyone in South Africa has cell phones, huh? So you don't have to do that anymore. when are you coming home? But while she was there, he was taking it for granted. Oh, you come home, the food is going to be ready, children are all dressed, children are going to be picked up, they're going to be taken to school, picked up. And he's thinking, oh, this just happens. But one day it's not happening, and he realizes, wow, this is kind of overwhelming. Yeah. So there are times when we don't realize how complex, but sometimes we have a chance to do somebody else's service, and we realize that it's not as easy as we expected. And sometimes it's good for people to have alternative arrangements where they can do different services, where they can appreciate that service and the servitor a little more by seeing the dynamics of what that individual, you know, has to deal with. Then it can help us to be more present, more supportive, and to have more gratitude as we watch and see other people do, you know, do various things. And just like we were saying, how in the days when Prabhupada was on the planet, we almost just considered that Prabhupada would always be around. And then when Srila Prabhupada left, then in so many cases we were thinking, wow, I wish I would have spent more time with my guru. I wish I would have asked them this question or that question. I wish I had did this or did that. Many times when someone dies, leaves the body, and those who remain are so disturbed, so depressed, so sad. But so often, their disturbance is more selfish. They're thinking, how could you leave this world? And we didn't finish paying off the bond for the house. Now I got to do it all by myself. How could you leave this world? Now I have to do all of this cleaning and all this work. How could you leave me with all these children? Now I have to take care of them. And they're thinking more in a selfish way of why the person could depart and leave them with more complexities in their life. Or they're in anxiety because they had a grudge, they had an argument, they had something that didn't get a chance, you know, to bring closure. So he's thinking, only if it could be, only if he didn't die so soon, I could have worked this out, worked that out. I didn't have a chance to ask the person for forgiveness. I didn't have a chance to go this place with them, do this, do that. And so they're feeling very disturbed because the opportunity was there. I was so busy doing my thing, only if I knew that this person was going to leave the body, I could have been more available to associate with them, to do this, do that. So many times, the problem, because of something that's still incomplete or didn't happen, didn't get finalized in the relationship. So now they're really sad. Oh, the person's gone now. But if you gave your best and did your best in your relationships with people, when someone leaves, yes, you feel some sadness that you won't see them, at least in this lifetime. But at the same time, you feel that you can honor their departure because you have done what you could with them, for them. And so it's not like there's so many things that are pending that didn't quite happen. And now you're in anxiety because you didn't give them enough time. You didn't fulfill your promise. You somehow accepted they were just going to be around. There was an... And it happens because we take things for granted. You know, when they had this attack in America during September 11th, and there was one plane where people were calling out to certain dear ones before they tried to attack these terrorists and take over the plane. And some of them had, you know, this conversation they went on. Now, one of them said, "Oh, I'm so sorry. It looks like we may never see each other. I'm sorry that we didn't have a chance to make better, you know, investments in the stock and bonds, you know." They didn't say, "Well, I'm going to miss you because we're not going to have a chance, you know, to go out, you know, and go to disco anymore. And I guess you got to find another partner." They didn't say, "Well, this is the last time I have a chance to talk with you, so I want to let you know how much I hate your guts. bye, I'm out of here." But what were they saying? "Oh, my beloved, you know, I love you so much." It was all about, you know, relationship. It wasn't about, "Well, it's so unfortunate, I'm not going to finish my degree. It's so unfortunate, I'm not going to be able to buy that house now. Because, you know, I'm going to die maybe. So unfortunate that we're not going to be able to see, you know, our wonderful, you know, soap operas, you know." And I wanted to know how that was going to end. I'm not going to be able to find out, you know. I'm going to miss this opportunity. It's unfortunate that that special wine we save for special occasions won't get a chance to, you know, drink it. And we paid so much for it, and it's in a cellar. Huh? And it's any other kind of thing. But their mood was, "Oh, I love you, and please tell the children that I love them so much." And everybody was calling, and that was their concern. So what it means is what's most important to us is genuine, healthy relationships. And even though we have to struggle with bills and bad health and all kinds of other things, that's there, but it's actually secondary to ultimately who we are. Because those things are always going to be some kind of problems, you know, will be there. And so what happens then is that things that's really most essential to our existence, we so often don't give them the kind of attention that we should. I mean, just you know, we had this kind of reflection many times, but let's just think about it at this time. Just think that if each of us who are sitting here knew that we were going to die in like 3 days, what things is in your life that would become extremely important, like some things now that we're not giving sufficient attention to, we give so much attention to those things. And some things we're giving a lot of attention to wouldn't mean anything to us because we would consider, it's not so important. I'm going to die in 3 days. So there are certain things that we make priorities that really need to be readjusted. And there are certain areas we need to make them more of a priority. Because so often when we do leave this body, we are not really aware that we're going to go. That most people who die, they don't know that they're going to die in an hour. They're going to die in a day. In many cases, it's rather kind of abrupt. And even when they do know, in many cases, it's like too late because they've wasted so much of their life just trying to do what other people felt they should do, or trying to connect with the fads, and trying to look good, rather than be good. And so much of their life has been posturing, has been facade. Then at the time of death, all of that now comes back to either haunt us, or it comes back in a wonderful way because we have invested our time in those things that's most essential. So we don't want to be gloomy in that we're known as the Hare Krishna people who always think about death. Why? We're always talking about death. Get ready to have a death that you have to realize you can die at any moment. But this is life. Life is that everything is born and dies. And that everybody's got to check out at some time. And so you can get a notice for eviction. And you can consider, well, I don't want to think about that. But then one day, you're out of a place. I don't know if they do it here, but in America, when someone gets evicted, they're given a notice, they're given some time. Then at some point, the sheriff deals with these things in the counties, and they send people there who come with guns, and they go into your house, and even though you're in the house, they take every single thing out of the house, and they put a new lock on the place, and they put all your property on the street. And sometimes the people in very wonderful, places, they have had a good job, and they bought a big, beautiful house, something happened, some calamity, some divorce, they got sacked, now they can't continue paying the bond. Sometimes they may have been 90% almost finished paying, but the bank doesn't care, the bank is happy. We got so much of your money, and now we're going to get your house also. So here this person has struggled and been a little successful and has gotten all this opulence, and now they get put out of their own house, like a rogue who's been thrown out into the streets. And in America, it's so vicious that when this happens to people, cars will drive by and they will stop right while the person is sitting down there crying or going to try to find some trailer or something to take their things in storage, trying to figure out what to do. People will just come by and open up their car, take their television, put it in there, drive away. Take their hi-fi, put it in, drive away. Go looking through the clothes, get bundles of clothes, put it in. Go tell somebody else, hey, somebody got evicted on such and such a street. you better go there fast because they're probably going to get a trailer pretty soon and get the things, And then sometimes the person is sitting right there while people come in grabbing their things. They're already totally in distress, they financially in the disturbed, now that things are put out, and maybe it's them and one or two children, and then people just coming by, grabbing their stuff like that. Well, it shows how even you can have things, but things can change overnight. Every day, there's somebody who was successful who now has gone bankrupt. Every day, there's somebody who was enjoying life, and then they went to the doctor, and the doctor says, come in, I think we need to talk. I'm sorry to tell you, but you're HIV positive. But don't worry, you have a lot of company. There are thousands, millions of people. Or the doctor calls you in, I think you better come in tomorrow and bring your husband, because I need to talk to you, both of you. We will talk then. From your test, I'm afraid to tell you, you have cancer. And, it's in the third degree. And the person is thinking now, their whole conscience totally shifts because now they're having to look at life in a different perspective. Now, some people can use that in a healthy way because now they're more careful about, mindful about the existence, and now they're not taking things so much for granted. And so for some people, that disease or sickness has now been the best blessing for them because it's helped them to really to carry out what this life is all about. But then other people will become angry, and now they'll do all kind of harm to others because they're mad at life. They feel life has given them, you know, a bad deal. But it's happening every day that someone who was successful goes bankrupt, someone who was very trusting and found out that they've been cheated by the, you know, the lover. Someone is committing suicide. Someone is being killed. Every day somebody's finding that they have a serious chronic disease. Abruptly. And so this shows again how things are constantly in flux. And we have to be grateful and use what we have as we can and while we can and be appreciative, because we never know when, you know, there may be some change. I was talking my last visit to West Africa, and I was meeting with a very famous, you know, human, civil rights worker, freedom worker, etc., who's connected with the UN. And he was particularly overseeing a project with refugees. And so we were talking about how to counteract this problem, minimize it, the devastation, the effects of it. And so he was telling me how he had amazing realization once when one president of one country, who he personally was trying to get that president to be more kind to his citizens, and he knew that this guy was going to engage in war and it was going to cause a big problem. So he said a few years later, he was in his refugee camp. And who did he see in the camp, looking very miserable, was the president of the country. That by his own harsh policies, he had wound up experiencing such heavy reactions from what he had created. And so there he's going from being president of a small West African country, you know, to being dethroned, and now a refugee, where he had so much money and power and influence, and now he was just at the mercy, of handouts, and was being treated very harsh, you know, in the refugee camp, because some of the people were very angry that they're in that situation because of him. And so this can happen, that one can be in a very semi-secure situation, have things in a very comfortable way, but by karma, there can be a change overnight. So we should never be too comfortable whatever is going on and take things for granted. But at the same time realize that the material world is full of duality. And with this duality, things not only do change, but they must change, and they will change. And when we are properly situated, when there's a change, we just find ways of how to deal with that, and we go on with our life. So if somebody finds that they have a very chronic disease, they realize that this is the nature of the body. Is that one thing or another is going to be bothering us? Somebody has death in the family, and of course there's a big loss, but at the same time, they look back and they think, I associated the best way I could with this person, and I told them how I loved them and cared for them while when they were existing, and now I don't have to feel so sad and depressed that really I never really took time and cared for this person. Never even told them, you know, that I love them. Never really went out of my way, you know, to try to assist them in such ways. So you or that person is going to leave at some point. And when we do have to leave, will we be fit and ready? See, the Prabhupada said how life is how to die like Grandfather Bhishma. Grandfather Bhishma was a very special entity, of course, that at the time of death, even though he had been involved in warfare, was lying on a bed of arrows, in a very semi uncomfortable situation, but he was just wanting to see Krishna, and just focused in his spirituality, and just speaking to Yudhisthira, words of wisdom. And so he was just fully raptured in the darshan of Krishna. Krishna was fully accepting and giving love. And so we have to understand that life is really about coming to a point of being so focused, in spite of whatever's going on, our spiritual connection is there. And then when we leave the body, you know, we go, you know, gloriously in such a way. So let's stop there. See what questions that you might have. These are some questions that were compiled. Bodhisiddhanta requested one of his devotees, gave him blessings, to compile this work. And this book is from all many different writings and sayings and teachings of Bhakti Vinod on very specific topics. Something was poured out on a different topic. So the question is there, and then it's answered in such a way. Because this transcendental knowledge is very inclusive and includes so many different areas. Did anyone have any question or any comment? It's amazing how we learn to do something that's improper. That we get reinforcement in how to accept that which is unhealthy. We first, somebody starts smoking and they learn how to smoke. They start drinking and learn how to accept it. Start eating abominable things, doing abominable things. You just kind of learn, you know, oh, you know, how to do this. And then it becomes a part of them, even though it's so uncomfortable, you know. Sometimes the dress styles and things, the way people live, like so uncomfortable. But they consider, oh, this is stylish. Hmm? You see these poor girls, and they got this dress all the way up to their navel, you know, short dress. You feel, one, they cheated themselves, because it's such a little cloth that they paid for. It's so much, but such a little cloth. They got cheated. And then when they sit down, they're so uncomfortable. Huh? They got to constantly... They got to hide something over them. Hide. They got so uncomfortable. Why do they make themselves so uncomfortable? So unnatural. Huh? They wear these heels. They learn how to walk in the heels. Huh? They're so uncomfortable. Feet are hurting. They get dressed up. They go to a very, very elegant engagement. And they got all these tight things on, and the tight shoes are tight, and the clothes are tight, and they're just so suffering. And they're all this expensive dress, expensive jewelry, expensive things, and they're suffering. And they can't wait to get home. Just throw those, and so they walk in the door, and they kick those shoes off. They call that happiness, you know? That they paid, you know, like so much for these things. And the worst is when people are paying, you know, for poverty, you know. Now they got these jeans that you have to buy, they're expensive, and they got holes in them. Huh? I can't believe people would pay money, you know, to look poor. Hmm? A jacket, pants. I mean, you can see how people's minds are being controlled by these fads. And it's being organized in some ways. Let's get people to pay expensively to have a certain look. You have this kind of, that kind of look. Let's get the look of poverty now. Things look fragile. They pay serious money for it. Unbelievable. But people get to learn how to accept something. And it is so amazing. You see these young men and young boys, they're wearing pants, big baggy pants, they're falling off their butt. And they can barely walk, and you know, they're walking, they keep pulling it up. And they consider themselves cool. You know, their pants are falling off. You know? They're going to pick something up, fast forward. You know, hold up. They try to reach something, fast forward. They're just constantly walking in there, pulling their pants up. Unbelievable. And they pay big money to wear clothes that don't fit. You know? It's unbelievable. But because it's a fad, people accept. Oh, yes. We get those pants, you know. You can put three people inside the pants. Huh? But because it's considered to be, you know, to be stylish, then people wear it. It's just amazing. I remember many years ago, I was giving a little class, I was joking. I was saying, if a famous group of musicians start wearing their pants backwards, it'll become a fad. Some years later, someone told me, "America, you know, Mark, you mentioned that in one class. You know, there's this group, and they wear their pants backwards." But it is the fact that what prominent people do, it really picks up, and others start doing it. It doesn't mean that it's something that's really healthy. People learn, get trained up how to accept it. So people are trained up now to accept, oh, you got baggy pants, this is stylish. Where so many years ago, I saw somebody with baggy pants, he said, why don't you wear your clothes proper? Why don't you put on a belt? why do you buy these things? Four sizes are too big for you. But then, you know, it gets accepted. So there's so many things that become a part of acculturation that we accept that are really unhealthy for us. I mean, sometimes I wonder, you know, not trying to attack any styles, but I'm amazed at all the holes people put in their bodies, you know. And now they put these holes in their tongue. I wonder, how do people kiss? You know, I mean you get all of this stuff. Oh, excuse me. Can you take that out? I mean, unbelievable. You know, got these things in there, coming up in their tongue. Unbelievable. The holes everywhere. Well, austerity is there. I guess it's how to use austerity. People are taking, you know, the ritual different ways. But it's a sign that people do want to identify. They do form different kinds of groups and coalitions, and certain things make you in, certain things, you know, cause you to be considered a nerd. I mean, certain things that people do, they say, oh, yes, this is stylish. Just, you know, just see, you know, what he's got. They got all the tattoos all over. Look at all the holes. Huh? The two in the tongue and one in the eyebrow. Unbelievable. They put holes in your eyebrow, holes in your tongue. Huh? But it's becoming a fad, and it's accepted. People learn how to deal with that. And when they go for the tattoos, it can be very painful. It can be very dangerous also, the needles. But because it's accepted, now people put tattoos everywhere. And it's considered, oh, yes, special tattoo. Unbelievable. Any questions, any comments? Anyone ask? It's amazing. With the raggedy pants, people pay so much for baggedy pants. You know, they get cheated. Instead of buying a whole piece of cloth, they get a little short piece of cloth. And they're so uncomfortable with such things, tight things. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Why did you mention that, in general,
well, if you think about it, how do we have bad relationships with people? Because the opposite of that. We have bad relationships because maybe of some conflict. Something has happened that could have happened a different way. Sometimes we allow that one event to cloud, you know, the whole relationship. And then we hold grudges and whatnot. So we keep thinking about that problem that happened. It makes us angry and angry and angry and disturbed. Now, we can do the opposite. We can meditate more on someone's good qualities. We can become more and more absorbed. This doesn't mean to be in denial. We can become more and more absorbed of the amazing good things that that person does. So as we begin to appreciate that individual more, then naturally, if we appreciate someone, we relate to them, you know, in a particular way, because we appreciate. So again, one is not to be naive, but at the same time, we are to try to look at the good qualities and try to understand somebody's needs, you know, and struggle. Now, if someone just constantly keeps abusing us, cheating us, disappointing us, we have to deal with that. The reality, this is the way this person functions, and we have to do what's necessary to not to allow them to do that, because then they hurt their own spiritual life.
And so we don't just, you know, become like a doormat. But one should first try not to overreact when there is an issue, or just look at the poor quality that someone may have when you have so many other things, you know, that are nice qualities. So that means we can appreciate people by just literally looking more closer at what they do that's good. As we look at that more, we begin to have a more of a relationship with the person, you know, based on what they do is good. Instead of being so quick to look at what, you know, areas that they're a little slack in this way. As we appreciate people more, then we do more things to try to help to facilitate their well-being. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. Earlier on in the talk, you spoke about us being products of relationships and the environment. So in terms of culture, a lot of us come from different cultural backgrounds. And from that experience, we require different scripts and schemes for interpreting reality.
Mm-hmm.
Now we come to the devotional environment, and we're given a whole new way of looking at things. So what the state I'm at, I'm still reacting on my own conditioning, and I've tried to construct the energy on the basis. But it's still very superficial. I mean, I have an experience and then I construct it according to what chapter says. But emotionally, my being is not just that construction, it's still with my old condition. So how do you change that? I mean, do you just try and have a different approach for the day that it's going to change? Or do you carry on performing that mental gymnastics over and over again to practice the way you think of the
Well, it's a process. Like our mind has gotten trained to have a certain kind of construct based on, you know, heredity, you know, ethnicity, all those things. That was trained. We worked ourselves into that. And so we also work ourselves into accepting, you know, transcendental perspectives. This is, we are so much conditioned to accept, you know, that we are these bodies. And it took a lot of programming to get us, you know, to accept that. Much, so many things about society gives that kind of programming. And so now, just to try to think differently overnight, no, it's a process. First, by realizing that there's a different way of how to evaluate and how to perceive, how to codify. And now trying to give a little more attention to this other way that now can take you out of what was kind of almost forced on us in such ways. So we shouldn't feel too disturbed that it doesn't just happen overnight. Because the conditioning didn't happen overnight, you know, that we now have. Some cases didn't happen over one lifetime, you know, many, many lifetimes. But because the transcendental is our real identity, what we're really doing is trying to remove some of the acculturation. So we're not really trying to create now a whole new way of dealing with the world. We're really trying to get back to what was with us, was a part of us. And so that's, you know, that's a process. Mm-hmm.
What's the best way to inspire people?
Well, you know, the example, all of us know that the best way, you know, is by our own examples. As everything is said and done, unless a person is pure, we're basically selfish entities. And so even being selfish is not necessarily bad, in that if we're selfish in a good way, we see some good qualities, we want to have those qualities. We see somebody happy, we also want to be happy. And so then people will take advantage in a good way of a good example. They see at work that other people get so angry, disturbed, but you are more focused. They see that you have integrity, that you do what you do good. Then people will naturally become a little more interested in who you are and what you believe. Especially when you do anything with excellence, as long as it's not sinful, you do things with excellence, it draws attention and appreciation. So those of you who are working outside, you should also see your job as a chance to do it as an offering to Krishna. As long as it's not sinful, you do it as an offering to Krishna. And by doing that, in a mindful, meticulous way, that can be a big expression of preaching. because people will appreciate you as a person, and then they will appreciate or try to understand what is the philosophy that you, that your life, you know, is based on. And if you do things whimsically, then people will take it the opposite way. They'll say, oh, just see, she really can't carry out her assignment, she can't do her work. No, it's because she's a Hare Krishna, you know. You know, they rise up early in the morning, I was chanting Hare Krishna, they just eat, you know, just carrots and apples and rabbit food. So they have no intelligence, no strength, no perseverance, no passion to do this, do that. So they will blame the movement and the philosophy where, you know, where you're lacking. And where you are excelling, then people will take what you believe more seriously because they'll see it's really made you a better person. And they'll be eager to understand, so how can I also become better? Maybe I should also go and find out the secrets of the Hare Krishna and so I can benefit, you know, like this person has. Any last questions anyone has? Okay. Individuals are looking for opportunity. People are looking for pleasure, looking for happiness. And we are influenced by the environment, especially by the fads and the leaders and the role models. You know, that's how civilization unfolds. Yes?
Should we ever give up on inspiring people, even though we have the change?
We shouldn't give up on them intellectually, but we should surely give up on them in terms of external output. Meaning that if somebody is so fixed in whatever they would do, and they have no desire to change, we can try to present to them and make things available. But we really shouldn't keep trying to impose or force or keep on demanding when somebody's not willing, you know, to change themselves. It's just like you are, you know, a teacher, and so you have, you know, a lot of students, but there's one or two students who really are so stubborn that they don't want to come to class, they don't want to learn. So you can't allow the whole class to be sacrificed because of those students. There are people who are ready to respond, who can benefit, who you can help, and so you have to give everybody opportunity, but if someone is not taking advantage of it, then you can't jeopardize the others or jeopardize your own time that could be given in more, you know, of a constructive way.
So does that mean we must improve our evaluation of how much we feel we connect to that individual until a certain time and then there is a cutoff point?
Yeah, about everything. In other words, things should produce results. And there should be some process for evaluation about anything. Only a foolish person we'll keep on doing something without taking inventory and making an evaluation to see if it's worth doing it, if it should continue. No, we have to, from time to time, in every aspect of our life, we have to kind of look a little closer to see where do we want to go, where are we now, and how far or do we need to do, what we need to do to get there, what are we trying to do, assist with others, and what is happening. This is why it's even considered an offense, but offense number 9, to preach to the faithless, which means that sounds almost like a contradiction, because we are told to be merciful, kind to all, so Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam Yeshu. We are told that also to preach to every town, every village, to the Chaitanya town, the Grani Gram. But then what does it really mean? Don't preach to the faithless. It means we try to share with everyone. But then if someone becomes offensive, or someone becomes antagonistic and you're trying to preach to them, then by continuing preaching to them, you are actually making things worse. Because now they're getting more and more heavy karma for, you know, the way that they're reacting. And so if someone, you know, one shouldn't think, well, this person is really needs help and is a devotee, but he don't know it, doesn't realize you're a devotee. I'm just going to keep preaching and preaching and preaching, and I'll send them books, and I'll just go to the house, and I'll just share something with them, and I'll send them tapes, and I'll just keep on telling them, you're wrong, you need to do this, and eventually I'm going to get through. But eventually you got to make that person more and more disturbed, feeling that you are pushing them, you're imposing on them, and so it's not really going to help them. And so we are to assist and make things available, but we shouldn't force, because everybody is having their own, you know, freedom. It's our duty to be kind and to share, but never should we feel we have to force something on someone. Any last questions? Yes. Anger too often means that we want something to happen in a very specific way. Because it didn't happen in that specific way, we lose it. We become disturbed. So sometimes anger means that we have to be less attached to the ultimate outcome. Sometimes anger means that we have to see how to be more compassionate than just being angry. When something is wrong, we have to look closer at maybe why the person is doing this or doing that. We have to look at what the person's, you know, perception was that allowed them to justify this. And so we try to see how to help. If we can't, then we have to back away also. But too often, anger causes one to lose the ability to do the right thing. Often anger causes one even to overreact. It causes us to lose some of our, you know, our compassion. Even when we have to act in a way that's aggressive to our beloved, sometimes it's good to wait until you're not angry. Like sometimes a child is disturbing you so much and you're so angry, then you overreact in the way you punish the child. So sometimes we have to regroup and then we do the necessary, but when we're, you know, more in control in this way. So anger often comes from a frustration of one's desires that not being fulfilled, become disturbed, things don't happen the way that we would like them to, you know, to happen. Or anger comes because we feel we were cheated, denied, abused. We feel that someone somehow didn't come through, you know, on their side. So we shouldn't be in denial that something was wrong, or wrong is a wrong. But at the same time, we should look at how can we help this person? How can we help this situation? And if we can't help it, how can we avoid ourselves, you know, being a victim of this other person's, you know, craziness and nonsense? How can we avoid ourselves losing our stability and our focus in such ways? And then many times we have to also be able to be more forgiving that a wrong was done and that person is sick. So we want to be disturbed with the action, but be able to somehow to separate that from the individual. We still must be concerned about the well-being of that person. Okay. Anything?
How does one overcome being self-righteous, maybe being self-righteous? And also, does that process, like, just come from not feeling comfortable with yourself in this
world? Well, we have to look closer at what exactly is the self-righteousness. There's nothing wrong who's trying to share and present something that will help that person ultimately. But there's something wrong if we have arrogance and we're just considering that we're so much better and we're approaching the person, you know, in that kind of mood. We should approach because we're concerned and we are concerned and we stand higher standard of life and existence. So that's there. Otherwise, what happens is that we'll accommodate all kind of things. And consider, well, everyone has their own truth. Everyone should do what feels good, and we shouldn't be judgmental. But civilization is based on standards and criteria. And people who have integrity, they judge themselves and they judge others. They have certain standards that they expect, and when not, you know, they're disturbed. So we should be concerned about standards and ethics and morality, good character, but not that we should feel that we're so much better than someone else. If anything, we should feel, how can we improve our own potency so we can be able to help that person even more? How can we improve in our own way of delivery to help that individual understand, you know, why they need to change? And like in the case where
Gandharvik was mentioning, what about a situation where a person just seems that they're not willing to change? Then we, you know, we release our attachment to that situation, and we have to offer our best, you know, but then not to get so entangled where it turns into almost the opposite. One just gets angry at you, even though you're trying to help, or they become offensive. So all of you, please keep coming to visit and try to read books as much as you can. Srila Prabhupada has given us like so many wonderful books, and that answers practically any question you can practically have or conceive. And as you take the book home and the japa beads or audio tapes and different things that the devotees can make available, all this paraphernalia helps to stimulate our dormant consciousness. It helps us to become more sensitive to the fact that there's amazing alternatives to life. It helps us to feel more solace and comfort as each person is undergoing their own individual types of struggles. It becomes overwhelming sometimes, but we can be less disturbed by this as we are nourishing, you know, our consciousness by hearing spiritual music and reading spiritual books and reflecting spiritual topics, discussing with people who are also involved in spirituality. Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Bhavadki. Jai.